Daily news and analysis. We keep you informed and inspired.
This is World Today.
Israel has been checking whether its airstrikes had killed Hamas's deputy military leader Marwan Issa in Gaza. Japan's economy narrowly avoided recession after revising its official economic growth figures. The Caribbean community has announced the resignation of Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry. Welcome to World Today, a news program with a different perspective. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. To listen to this episode again or to catch up on previous episodes, you can download our podcast by searching World Today. Israel has been checking whether its airstrikes had killed Hamas's deputy military leader Marwan Issa in Gaza. If confirmed, Issa would be the highest-ranking Hamas official killed since October. Israeli military operations across the Gaza Strip struck multiple Hamas targets on Monday. With the Muslim holy month of Ramadan beginning on the same day, Palestinians in Gaza have embarked on fasting after months of starvation. Noah Harazin has more from Gaza.
Normally, in the first day of Ramadan, Palestinians here in Gaza will go out to the markets, buy some good quantities of food and goods, supplies for the holy month of Ramadan, buy some lights and decorations for this, for their homes. But this is one different Ramadan. People are afraid. They are depressed. The Kamal Adwan Hospital, which is located in Jabalia refugee camp in northern Gaza, said that two more children died because of the starvation situation in northern Gaza is just deteriorating. We are talking about a famine, malnutrition. I mean, people in the north are starving. In some areas, actually, in the north, it reached a point where people have nothing to eat. They are feeding on the grass on the streets, and some of them are feeding on the feed of the animals. So yes, the situation there is very, very, very hard. People are also living in the fear of being killed at any moment, especially with the continuous Israeli attacks on the Gaza Strip, even in the green areas like Middle Gaza and Rafah. So yes, Ramadan this year is very different to the Palestinian people. And even though that they had big hopes, actually, over the past few weeks that maybe Hamas and Israel would come to a ceasefire agreement. However, now they are living through the fact that maybe until the end of Ramadan there will be no ceasefire, and they actually have to cope with this situation, and they have to cope with the very little goods and supplies available in the markets.
That was Noah Harazin reporting from Gaza. For more on this, I earlier talked to Dr. Wang Jin, associate professor at Northwest University in Xi'an, and here's our conversation. Egypt, Qatar, and the United States had sought to broker a truce between Israel and Hamas before the start of Ramadan. That had failed. How do you see the possible reasons?
I see several reasons could explain the failed efforts to bring the two sides together. On the one hand, I think because the stances actually between the brokers, actually they are still differed very greatly, because we see although that many of the regional countries they want to ceasefire, they want peace, but actually how to reach the ceasefire, how to realize the goals. They have different approaches. For example, Egypt might hope to maintain the very, very important role, while also hope to respect the ideas and opinions from Israel. While on the other hand, I think Qatar hope to respect more opinions from Hamas. So actually, the stances are not the same. And the second, I think the United States also played a very negative role during the past weeks, especially the United States continue to supply Israel with the massive waves of the weaponries, supplies, and also continue to encourage Israel military action in the Gaza Strip. That also, to some extent, this encourage the process of negotiations and the brokering efforts. And also we cannot forget that Israel and Hamas, their stances especially the gap between the stances are still very great and apparent because Hamas hope to use the exchange of detainees as a very major approach to maintain, to go back to peace, to the status before the last October the 7th, when the latest round of the crisis erupted. But Israel hopes to only to conduct the very exchange of detainees rather than mentioning other issues. So that is why I think that many factors then finally lead to the very failed efforts of the negotiations and the mediation from the regional international process.
Indeed, in an interview with Politico, the media that was published on over the weekend, Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of Israel suggested he would, quote-unquote, like to see another hostage release, but there had not been a breakthrough in negotiations. Professor Wang, in more details, where does Israel stand now in terms of the conflict? What is Israel's plan?
I think Israel's plan is simple because on the one hand, Israel hopes to continue their military operations in the Gaza Strip to realize the goals of so-called eliminating the Hamas in the Gaza Strip. So that is why Israel does not want to make the peace or make the truce with Hamas as a very very final status between Israel and Hamas. They hope to continue their military action. So actually, exchange of detainees should only be the part of the plan rather than the very final stage of the plan. And on the other hand, according to the Israel's political landscape or political outlook in the Gaza Strip, they hope that the Hamas should be ousted from the future political structure in the Gaza Strip. So that is why when Hamas maintained that they hoped that the peace could be restored, that the Israel should withdraw their military forces from Gaza Strip and the returning of the Palestinian refugees in the Gaza Strip, that would be unacceptable for Israel, because Israel hopes that Hamas should be ousted from the political structure in the future Gaza Strip, and also that hope that to ensure that to establish the mechanism to ensure the very absolute safety of Israel under that kind of the political outlook. So that is why Israel cannot accept the terms offered by Hamas, and that is why I don't think that the very peace or the ceasefire, even the ceasefire resulted from the exchange of detainees would be arrived within the very recent future.
U.S. President Joe Biden also talked to the media on the issue over the weekend. When he talked to MSNBC, he said that he remained hopeful the United States could still help broker a ceasefire between Israel and Hamas. I mean, we're looking back, why hasn't U.S. been successful in terms of bringing a ceasefire? And how do you see the role of the United States, moving forward in this?
I think United States, if we just look at what they are doing and what they have done in the diplomatic channel, okay, many would assume that, okay, United States has already done a lot, because they send a lot of envoys in the Middle Eastern countries, and their seniors visited Israel and the Palestinian Authority for many times, and their leaders expressed their concerns on many occasions. It seems that they had already done a lot. But we cannot forget besides the diplomatic channel, the United States is still continue to supply the military weaponry system to Israel, and still through that military channel that the United States encourage the Israeli military actions in the Gaza Strip. So that is very kind of a dilemma. On the one hand, they did encourage the military actions and hope that the peace would come as soon as possible. But on the other hand, they encourage and through their actions to encourage Israeli military action in the Gaza Strip. This is kind of a dilemma, or this is kind of the conflicting behaviors from the United States. So I don't think United States actually is doing the very positive role, playing positive role in the negotiation or the mediation efforts. I think United States should reconsider what they are doing and to find a way together with regional countries to find a solution as early as possible.
Well, Israel earlier had already kind of rejected a two-state solution. I mean, has that changed at all?
I think Israel's their stances over the two-state solution actually strengthened significantly during the past month. Two things provoked the anger of Israel. But we would explain later, because on the one hand, that the Hamas, from Israeli perspective, that Hamas provoked the war. So that is why Israeli believe, okay, the Hamas and other Palestinian military groups should not be trusted, and Israel should ensure their own safety through their own manners and through their own understanding. So that is why they rejected their leaders, Benjamin Netanyahu and other very hardliners, leaders from the right-wing and ultra-right-wing camps rejected repeatedly during the past weeks, the so-called two-state solution. But on the other hand, that during the past weeks, especially in the past months, after the last October the 7th, when the latest round of the war erupted between Israel and Hamas, the Palestinian Authority, led by Mahmoud Abbas, they have been under very, very pressing pressure from the Palestinian public opinion. So that is why the only thing that they could do is to pursue the Palestinian nation statehood in on many occasions in the international organization, especially in the United Nations. That actually conflict Israeli own interests. So that angered Israeli interests and also then make Israel feel the pressure from the Palestinians or feel the feel the rivalries from Palestinians. So that is why Israel on that occasions rejected the idea of the two-state solutions. But I don't think it will finally change the whole structure, because Israel will continue to hope to push forward the peace on internal and the comprehensive peace with Palestinians in the future. Once there will be the more proper and more entrusted mediators from international society. So that is why we say that very, very, the more entrusted and the more reliable mechanism for the mediation and the negotiation mechanism should be constructed as early as possible to facilitate the peace between Israel and Hamas.
Well, talking about that, Professor Wang, which regional power do you think could be playing more active roles in mediation, and what kind of mediation group could be formed, in your opinion?
I think actually every regional country should join the team, because when we are talking about the Middle East, is a region where the countries and actors interplayed with each other very closely. So once one's own ideas, one's own statement could then in turn affect the other states' opinions and other states' behavior. So that is why I think the regional states should be organized together with a unified opinion over the ongoing war between Israel and Hamas to try to reach a ceasefire between the different sides. But what is the problem is that actually these countries, they cannot influence directly the behaviors of Israel. They cannot influence directly the behaviors of Hamas. So that is why I think although the consensus actually matters, the regional countries' roles matter, but the most important thing that they should work together closely with international society to find and to establish the very newly established mechanism to encourage the possible peace between Israel and Hamas in the future as early as possible.
That was Dr. Wang Jin, associate professor at Northwest University in Xi'an, China. Coming up, Japan narrowly avoided recession. You're listening to World Today. We'll be right back.
Hello, my name is Alessandro Golombievsky Teixeira. I'm a professor of public policy management at Tsinghua University in Beijing. I am a great listener of The World Today. In my opinion, The World Today is one of the best China radio programs. In The World Today, we can get the best news and analysis in what is happening now in the world. So please, come to join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Japan's economy has narrowly avoided recession after revising its official economic growth figures. The new figures show the country's GDP increased 0.4% in the last 3 months of 2023 compared to a year earlier. This is up from earlier provisional data that showed a 0.4% contraction. Meanwhile, official data also shows that private consumption, about 60% of Japan's economy, fell by 0.3% for the same period. Despite the Japanese economy's struggles, Tokyo's stock market has been riding high since the start of this year. For more on this, my colleague Zhao Yang spoke with Yan Liang, a professor of economics at Willamette University.
So, Yan, Japan's economy narrowly avoids recession as its economic growth figures revised. So how do you view this revised figure? The GDP grows at 0.4% in the last 3 months of the year 2023. What does it tell us about Japan's economy?
Right. So I think what that means is that Japan narrowly avoided a technical recession. The major revision came from the capital expenditure. So investment has actually gone up by 2% quarter on quarter. And that is really helping with the GDP revision in the last quarter and for the whole year. That said, I think the economy is still pretty sluggish, especially, you know, when you look at the consumption demand, which account for, you know, 60%, the private consumption account for 60% of the GDP. And that has dropped by, you know, 0.3% in the final quarter of last year. And so I think, you know, there's still really problems with the economy, even though, you know, they have got the inflation up by 2.2% as of January this year. And that is down from 2.6% from December last year. So, you know, it seems that things are working in the direction that they wanted. But at the same time, I think there are new concerns about this inflation, also wage growth. And so I think the economy is due pretty lackluster, to say the least. I think they still have long-term structural problems that need to be fixed. But overall, I think it's due great news for them that they didn't have a recession in 2023.
And what are the main challenges do you think, you know, Japan's economy is facing right now?
Right. So I think they still have the problem of course, the insufficient of, you know, job creation, wage growth, especially, you know, the wage has been pretty flat in the past, you know, 2-3 decades almost. And now there's finally started to look at a potential wage increase. And then on the other hand, you know, the population aging, right? So that has been a long-term issue. 30% of the population is over 65 years old. And they also have been, you know, lack in terms of their investments in technological innovations and so on and so forth.
And while the revised figures mean that Japan escaped the recession narrowly, it continues to be the world's fourth largest economy after losing the number three spot to Germany. So how do you explain that? And both Germany and Japan face problems of declining population and labor shortage. But how different are their economic structures on other fronts?
Right. So I think the two economies share a lot of commonalities. Both are manufacturing powers. Both are, you know, exporting a lot. They're manufactured products. And so you're right. They switched place last year. And so I think one of the reasons is because, again, the Japanese yen has depreciated against the dollar for about 30% in the last 2 years. And so when you convert the Japanese economy, GDP, into the nominal dollar terms, and that really reduced Japan's, you know, GDP in measured in dollars. So Japanese's, you know, dollar GDP is at 4.2 trillion and Germany's is 4.5 trillion. So I think it remains to be seen if that's going to be the trend going forward. In other words, if Germany is able to keep that third place and Japan, you know, continues to remain at that, you know, fourth place and probably soon overtaken by India in a few years. But in terms of the challenges, you're right. Both countries face, you know, population aging problems. I think Germany is doing relatively better in terms of revising their immigration policies to try to attract more, you know, skilled immigrants into Germany. And Japan, as we know, is not a very, you know, sort of immigrant country. So that remains to be seen how they're able to, you know, cope with the problem. Of course, we know that Japan leads in the industrial robotics in the world. They have been adding a lot of robots in their service sector and manufacturing sector that in some ways help to offset, you know, the supply side problem due to population aging. But I think from the demand side, though, that remains to be a problem. As we just mentioned, you know, wage has been very slow to climb up. And so that really create a demand side problem. And of course, also in terms of, you know, innovations, you know, Japan used to be a really innovative powerhouse. But, you know, that started to really decline in the 80s, 90s, and they are yet to, you know, for example, digitalize their economy. For example, for digital payment system, they're still very much a cash economy instead of, you know, like China moving towards cashless, you know, digital payment system. So there's still many aspects I think Japan can innovate more and improve their productivity more.
Mm. And despite the Japanese economy struggles, Tokyo's stock market has been riding high since the beginning of this year. So what are the main factors for that?
Right. I think that has to do with, you know, really the corporate profits that has been really kept high. When you look at, for example, the corporate sort of the profits, it has been really rising in the past few years, you know, despite, as we talked about, the wage growth have been lackluster and you know, demand has been low. But the earnings for the corporate sector, for example, look at, you know, the last quarter of 2023, they were 45% higher year on year. So with this large amount of corporate savings, corporate earnings, and I think that is one of the reasons why the stock market has been performing so well. And you're right, the stock market now recorded a new high since, you know, 1989. So the corporations are doing well, but I think the problem is that, you know, a lot of corporations are not investing enough at home. And they're also not, you know, providing more sort of wage growth for their workers. So I think, in other words, you know, what benefits the corporate sector does not necessarily translate into the broader economy. On top of that, the government also, the Japanese government has also been, you know, giving very preferential sort of policies for corporations, right? The tax cuts and so on, whereas, you know, the consumers are facing higher consumption tax. So I think it's very interesting, you know, both in terms of their structural reasons that the Japanese, you know, corporations are able to, you know, improve their earnings and profits. And on the other hand, the policy supports have been really helping the corporates. And I think that requires, you know, some changes, I think, in government policies in terms of, you know, helping the consumers more and also help to stimulate domestic investments and digitization. So incentivize the companies to reinvest the profits into the real economy, the real innovations and investments.
Mm. And there are high expectations that the Bank of Japan may end its policy of negative interest rates introduced decades ago as soon as this month. So do you think this will happen? And if this happened, they end the era of cheap money, how could that impact Japan's economy?
Right. I think that is a really interesting question. I think the consensus that is that, yes, the BOJ is going to start raising rates could be as early as, you know, March the 18th when they met for when they meet for 2 days for the policy meetings. But I think it really depends on, as I mentioned earlier, the wage report that will come out on March the 15th. If the wage is going to really increase by you know, closest to 6%, right, as the Japanese trade union demanded, then it's likely that they are going to start hiking interest rate as early as the end of March. If not, I think the, you know, most of the consensus is that they probably will start raising rates in April. But regardless of exact timing of the rate hikes, I think it begs a very interesting question as to how this rate hikes are going to affect the economy. So I think it's clear the way that they see this, right, to hike the interest rate, and also, by the way, to relax the yield curve control. So in other words, to relax a little bit the long-term interest rate target. The way they wanted to do this is, of course, trying to contain inflation, which, as I mentioned, is now at 2.4% in January, and most of them are actually driven by food price and energy price. But I think there could be really interesting unintended consequences of the rate hikes. I think, you know, on the one hand, because the Japanese government has so much debt, and so once they raise the interest rate, they're going to pay a lot more debt service. And if the debt is held by, you know, private, for example, insurance companies and banks, that actually help to put more money into the private sector. So that could actually boost the demand side. And on the other hand, if they hike the interest rate, and that helped the Japanese yen to gain some strength against the dollars, then this could in some ways help with the inflation because that helped to lower the import prices, especially imported energies like oil and gas. So it remains to be seen, these two offsetting forces of rate hikes, how would that affect the economy?
That was Yan Liang, professor of economics at Willamette University. After the break, the latest in Haiti. This is World Today. We'll be right back.
I'm Dan Wang, Chief Economist of Hang Seng Bank China. The World Today is a real fun program. You will hear interesting people discussing global trend, economic event, what's happening in and outside of China. So, friends around the world, hope you can join us.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. The Caribbean community has announced the resignation of Haitian Prime Minister Ariel Henry. This came after regional leaders met in Jamaica to discuss a framework for a political transition in Haiti. Envoys from the United Nations, the United States, Canada, and France also attended the discussions. Haiti declared a state of emergency early this month after renewed violence led to two prison breaks. Armed gangs have been demanding the removal of Prime Minister Henry, who has been stuck abroad since last week. Here's Dan Collins with more from on the ground.
There seems to be no end in sight after weeks of violence and chaos in Haiti. Anti-government gangs continue to battle the police in the streets of the capital, Port-au-Prince. Tens of thousands of citizens have been forced to flee.
I am a mother of six, and I have to feed them every day and to give them food and water. But since I had to leave my home, I just sit here with nothing to cook. Life is awful. I hold the kids in my arms, but I have nothing to give them.
The situation is dire. The United Nations says half of some 11 million Haitians do not have enough to eat, and 1.4 million are starving. It's getting worse as food and water are running out. The International Organization for Migration says shelters are overflowing with more than 300,000 people displaced, at least 15,000 in the last week amid spiraling gang violence that killed thousands last year. Gangs have waged war on the population since interim president Ariel Henry traveled to Kenya last month, hoping to trigger the deployment of a UN-backed force of 1,000 Kenyan police officers. The gangs want Henry to step down, as does much of the population. The US State Department has called for a peaceful transition. US Secretary of State Antony Blinken traveled on Monday to Jamaica to meet with regional leaders in the Caribbean community. On the agenda, plans for a political transition in Haiti and the deployment of a multinational security force there. The State Department confirmed that Marines had been deployed to the U.S. Embassy in Haiti to reinforce security and evacuate non-essential personnel. Meanwhile, heavily armed gangs continue to assault neighborhoods and state institutions in the capital.
Dan Collins reporting from on the ground. For more, we're joined by Dr. Tim Anderson. He is director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. Thank you, Dr. Anderson. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you.
Now, Doctor, how would you comment, you know, on the current security in Haiti? I mean, how did it end up where it is right now?
Well, the problem is that there have been so many interventions, including military interventions in Haiti in recent decades, that this has really created some of the crisis that we're seeing now, basically. And there is still a foreign military occupation of Haiti by a so-called core group, while that core group tries to arrange a even deeper military intervention. And much of the protests have been against this last prime minister, Mr. Ariel Henry, whose resignation may be a circuit breaker there at the moment, because that had been demanded for some time. He was never elected. He took over after the assassination of the previous prime minister. But really, the U.S. plans for further intervention in Haiti are adding fuel to the fire, because there's great resentment about the previous U.S. interventions, in particular in Haiti.
Well, talking about that, Dr. Anderson, why wasn't, you know, election held after, you know, the previous president was assassinated to elect new officials in the country?
It was resisted by the U.S., which found Mr. Ariel Henry as a convenient puppet, if you like, for their agenda. They wanted to appoint and manage the leadership of Haiti. They've done it before. They organized, let's remember, a coup in 2004, 20 years ago. They haven't liked Haiti to be on any sort of independent path. They've wanted to be involved. They've organized these huge so-called aid programs, which have been robbed. The former president, Bill Clinton, apologized to Haiti some years ago for the damage that U.S. policies had done to Haiti's agriculture, for example. Haiti used to be able to feed itself, and it became dependent from the 80s and 90s on imports of rice from the U.S. because of what was done to the agricultural sector. The U.S. aid now has a program to try and register commercialize the land in Haiti, much of which has been under customary land tenure. There's a great fear that that's going to be robbing the people of their land. So, as I said, there's a great deal of resentment about previous interventions, and we're in the middle now of the talk of a new intervention with a black face, in the sense that they wanted to use Kenyan African soldiers as though that would give them some greater legitimacy in the Haiti situation. It doesn't really.
Ariel Henry said on Monday that he would step down once a transitional council had been established to pave the way for the election of a new president and help restore stability in the country. Dr. Anderson, how will this transitional council look like in your observation? What will be the purpose of it?
Well, the problem is the idea of a transitional council comes from this so-called core group, that is to say the US acting with France, with Canada, with some other countries. And it'll be seen as another attempt by outside powers, foreign military occupiers, with, as your introduction said, there are already U.S. Marines in the capital there. They want to appoint a new government. That will be resisted too.
Well, then, Dr. Anderson, to form a new government, what really needs to happen in Haiti, apart from, this possible transitional council?
Well, the those that are supporting the independence of Haiti and the mass movements in Haiti want to be able to do that themselves in their own time. They don't want a new appointed regime by outside powers. It's really as simple as that. The problem is that if the international community sees this core group led by the US as creating some sort of solution, they're not seeing the dysfunctionality of the history of that. It's going to be resisted by Haitian people, and some of those, by the way, so-called gangs, are genuine independent groups with former police and former military people there. Some of them have been set up by the US themselves to support their candidate. In the past, Mr. Henry and the new candidate, those gangs will be used, the ones that have been armed by the US. And let's remember, most of the weapons in Haiti have come from the US, and the US refuses to back an arms embargo on Haiti. So the militarization of these groups is really largely a result of weapons coming in from the US. So that's why I say the US is at the core of the problems here. And I think a US withdrawal from Haiti, which they're not inclined to do, they wanted to invest $100 million in this new military intervention operation. It really is something that's going to be resisted very strongly by the people in Haiti.
Well, more broadly, Dr. Anderson, how would you see the background of the rising gang balancing in the country, especially in terms of the economy and the society?
The problem has been that unless there is a government with legitimacy to create institutions, it's a very fragile environment there, because, as you know, Haiti has been hit by earthquakes and hurricanes. Some of the better aid programs there have come from some of its neighbors. The Cubans in particular, for example, have sent doctors there and have trained hundreds and hundreds of Haitian doctors to take the place of the Cubans there. So there has been some functional aid programs there, given the terrible history of these crises. But the problem is you always have these players that want to take advantage of a crisis and use it to their advantage. As I said, USAID has this program in the background hovering there since the earthquake of 2010 to try and make a cadastre and make a commercialization of the land in Haiti. And the land, of course, is essential to people being able to feed themselves there. So I think really a respect for the self-determination of the Haitian people to have a space and create their own institutions and have a type of respectful aid at an arm's length without this foreign construction of transitional regimes and new puppet regimes created by the core group. That's something that's really most resented in Haiti at the moment, and that's the key barrier, I would say, at the moment to some new functional independent institutions being created in Haiti.
Thank you. That was Dr. Tim Anderson, Director of Center for Counter-Hegemonic Studies, a Sydney-based think tank. You're listening to World Today. Stay with us.
Hi, I'm Einar Tangen, a political and economic analyst and senior fellow at the independent Taiher Institute. World Today is news without the hype and business commentary that is informed and up to date, presenting the facts and asking incisive questions. So, join us if you are someone who needs to know what is happening in China as it is happening.
Welcome back. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. India says it will lift the most import tariffs on industrial products from four European countries in return for investments of billions of dollars. This comes after India and the European Free Trade Association, or EFTA, signed an economic pact that concluded nearly 16 years of negotiations. The deal will see investments worth $100 billion over 15 years in such sectors as pharmaceuticals, machinery, and manufacturing. The EFTA is made up of four non-European Union countries, namely Switzerland, Norway, Iceland, and Liechtenstein. The news comes ahead of the general election due by May, at which Prime Minister Narendra Modi will seek a record third term. For more, my colleague Xu Yawen spoke with Swara Singh, Professor of International Relations at Jawaharlal Nehru University.
Professor Singh, could you firstly brief us how significant is the trade and economic partnership agreement between India and the four European countries in terms of investment and job creation for India?
Thank you for having me on your program. And the agreement that you just mentioned is called India European Free Trade Association Trade and Economic Partnership Agreement. And as you mentioned, it has a target of ensuring $100 billion of investment in next 15 years and creating about 1 million jobs. These are really clearly outlined targets. The other advantages that accrue from it is that it creates positive atmospheres for India's similar negotiations with the European Union. As you understand, these are four countries that are actually not EU members. These are Iceland, Liechtenstein, Norway, and Switzerland. And India is also similarly negotiating with the European Union and, of course, with the United Kingdom. So this could also create positive atmosphere for that. And, of course, provide an overall boost to Indian competitiveness as a trading nation.
Well, in the agreement, the four European countries demanded modifications to India's patent and regulatory law, granting drug manufacturers a six-year exclusivity period for new drug trial data. But the Indian government rejected the request. So how do you assess the impact of this agreement on India's pharmaceutical industry, considering the issue of data exclusivity and the significance for India's generics market?
As you understand, particularly in generic medicine, India is called the pharmacy of the world. And India has concerns about the exclusivity of data. And that also is driven partly because Indian pharmaceutical industry, when negotiating for exports to European countries, has often faced lobbies of major multinational companies in Europe. And therefore, there are kind of additional registration, certification processes that are put in place, which are called technical barriers. So the pharma sector has faced some of these challenges, and that obviously makes India sensitive in sharing that data of Indian pharmaceutical sector drug making.
We have also learned that other than this deal, over the past 2 years, India has also signed trade agreements with countries like Australia and the UAE and is in the final stages of negotiating trade agreements with the United Kingdom and the European Union, as you just mentioned. Considering the Modi government's withdrawal from the RCEP, the Regional Comprehensive Economic Partnership, in November 2019, what factors have prompted the Modi government to undergo such a significant policy shift?
I think that's a good comparison, that RCEP, which is Regional Comprehensive Trade Partnership Arrangement, India's primary concerns were fundamentally two, or three actually. One was that of the 15 countries plus India, India had a problem of trade deficit with 11 of them and continuing an enduring formidable trade deficit. And since the consideration was not that India's skilled manpower will find access in these countries. India thought that and the trade deficit would continue. And of course, India also wanted to protect its small, micro and medium industry. So that was a separate issue when it comes to RCEP. But even in case of India's negotiations, for example, with these four countries that we just mentioned, the non-European Union countries with whom India has now signed partnership agreement, these negotiations continued for 16 years. Similarly, for European Union, also 15 years negotiations continued. And of course, one has seen a little fillip in India's becoming more proactive and, as you mentioned, signing FTAs with Australia and the UAE, United Arab Emirates. That has given a boost to India's trade and investment with these two cases. For example, UAE is now seen as third largest trading partner of India. And of course, investments are rising from both sides in that sense. So in that sense, that this has created a kind of a new environment for India, particularly with India now being projected as the fifth largest economy, likely to become third largest economy, has likewise put also itself more ambitious trade figures. And the target that Modi government has put it for itself is to take India's foreign trade to $1 trillion. So in that sense, India is becoming more proactive in signing FTAs with more and more partner countries as much as possible. And I think this partnership agreement with these four non-EU European countries should create positive atmospherics for both India's FTA negotiations with the European Union and United Kingdom.
How do you see the agreement influencing India's broader trade strategy and economic development? And also, how will these agreements influence India's ongoing negotiations with other trading partners like the UK and the European Union?
I think what is clearly noticeable in this particular agreement, and of course agreements with Australia and United Arab Emirates, is India becoming more and more receptive and agreeable to sort of being flexible in terms of, sort of bringing down or even removing tariffs. In this case, for example, the agreement that we are discussing now, particularly sectors like pharmaceutical, machinery, manufacturing, are going to majorly sort of take care of removing tariffs. With, for example, one of these four countries, major of the four countries, India's economic relationship with, for example, Switzerland, is going to reduce, remove actually tariffs from about 95% of imports that India does from Switzerland. Particularly, gold is one item where, India is going to bring down tariffs and remove tariffs in that sense. So India is increasingly becoming far more receptive is how India is kind of projecting itself. And I think that should, as I said, boost opportunities for trade, investment and employment, etc. for India and, of course, also for its partner countries.
In light of Prime Minister Modi's economic initiatives and the upcoming general elections, some people say the free trade agreement, which is only a few weeks away from the Indian general election, will give a boost to the Modi government. What's your take on that? How do you think this free trade deal is shaping the public opinion and also electoral dynamics?
I think this can be seen in both ways. One, that India is going into general elections and that the election commission will invoke a code of conduct, which means India's government cannot take policy decisions as it goes into general elections. That obviously could be one way of looking at why this kind of agreement is sort of made possible just in time, as we say. And of course, it is also driven by the fact that the more major decisions and achievements India can showcase in foreign policy, like this agreement, is bound to have positive impact in terms of acceptability of government in general elections. And that kind of positive spin-off can also be expected to be the kind of trigger to ensure that this agreement happens in time. But I assume the FTAs with the United Kingdom and European Union are still going to take time because there are several key outstanding issues that still remain there, which I am trying to say is that, it's not just the fact that general elections are happening, that India has kind of hurriedly signed this kind of economic partnership agreement with these four nations. India has been careful where there are things where India thinks that need not be signed in a hurry and we need to negotiate still more rigorously. So apparently, yes, to some extent, elections can be seen as a factor, but I don't think they are the sole factor pushing India to sign such an agreement.
Swara Singh, professor of international relations at Jawaharlal Nehru University. This is World Today. Stay with us.
Welcome. I'm Ilaf Elard, economics professor and member of the Data Science and AI Center at New York University, Shanghai. On the World Today program, you can find in-depth and impartial insight, as well as critical commentary on key trends in the Chinese economy, financial technology, business, and blockchain. To prepare for the world tomorrow, join me on World Today.
Welcome back to the show. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. A new report shows that arms imports to Europe nearly doubled in the 2019 to 2023 period compared to the previous four-year period. The report released by the Stockholm International Peace Research Institute, or SIPRI, says Ukraine emerged as the largest arms importer in Europe and the fourth in the world over the past 5 years. The report also showed that around 55% of arms imports by European states from 2019 to 2023 were from the United States. The latest SIPRI report on international arms transfers details the import and export of weapons around the world between 2019 and 2023. For more, we're joined by Kamal Makili Aliyev, affiliated researcher at Raoul Wallenberg Institute of Human Rights and Humanitarian Law in Sweden. Thank you, Kamal. It's good to have you back on the show.
Thank you for having me again. Thank you.
Now, first up, this latest report by SIPRI is titled Trends in International Arms Transfers 2023. It said, you know, these imports to Europe nearly doubled, while the global volume of international arms transfers decreased marginally by 3.3%. So how would you see this background of such a drastic increase in European countries?
Well, first of all, we need to distinguish between two periods, right? Between 2014 and 2019 and 2019 and 23. I would say that the difficulty here is in trying not to conflate everything together. But if we take it overall, since 2014, the number of armed conflicts around the European region have grown substantially. Mm. So that explains the overall trend of why Europe is increasing its imports generally. You know, member states of the European Union, the outlying states, the Eastern European states, et cetera. That's connected to the conflicts in Ukraine, to the conflicts in the Middle East, to the conflicts in the North African region, including the, you know, aftermath of the internal conflicts in Libya, for example. So all of that is influencing the trend. And as we can see, it nearly doubled for the European continent. And if we distinguish between the two periods of time, we will need to distinguish between the European attempts to revitalize its security due to the general threats that the European region perceived from, for example, the conflicts in the Middle East and North Africa. And then, of course, from the conflict in Ukraine, in the Eastern Ukraine. And then in 2019-23, we see this trend continuing and even being, you know, substantially, growth of the substantial imports for the Europe because of the Ukraine and this full-scale war between Ukraine and Russia. Mm. So those two things have seriously bumped the imports compared to the another trend that has been there in the world, a slight decrease in the imports, but that is not connected to the reduction of the conflict in the other parts of the world. That is connected to the inability of the other world to keep up with the rising prices because of the inflationary tensions in the whole global economy, and that means that the other countries cannot simply spend as many resources of accumulating arms and arm imports as, for example, the richer countries.
But doesn't But doesn't that the decrease in other parts of the world say something about, you know, their unwillingness to really to join, you know, the wars in different parts of the world?
Not that slight increase. I would wish that it to be true, but because the increase is very slight, right? As a global trend, it's only 3.3%. It more looks like the average inflation trends and the pressure that is going up everywhere in the world, and that is, you know, consistent with what is happening. But there is also the problem is with arm imports. They are not dependent only on the, for example, willingness or unwillingness of a state. They're simply connected to the objective perception of the conflict in the world. And if you look at the CIPRI report, you'll see that the perception of the conflict in the world did not change. We still have the same kind of, you know, conflict trends everywhere.
But then, you know, shouldn't we be alarmed, you know, by the absolute increase, you know, of weapons or arms deals, you know, in Europe? And shouldn't that be discouraged?
I'm not sure how it can be discouraged in considering the amount of the conflict that we have. Of course, the trend is alarming, but the trend is reactionary. It's not proactive trend. It's not that the Europe is militarizing because it's preparing for expansionist policy or trying to proactively create a more insecurity. It's started to militarize because it left its defense budgets really weak after the beginning of the 1990s. It wasn't even, you know, reaching those 2% of the GDP standard.
Stop you there because we're running out of time, but certainly, you know, this is a very tricky issue and different people would speak on the necessity for differently on the necessity for Europe to really to arm itself. But we thank you for your time and your insight. That was Kamal Makili Aliyev. That was all the time we have for this edition of World Today. I'm Liu Kun in Beijing. Thank you for staying with us. Bye for now.